Thank you, Gary. My name is Bob, and I'm out of Pauley. I'd like to thank Billy for asking me to come up here tonight. We had a beautiful drive, and thank Jake for riding up with me. Had a nice, relaxing time. It's kind of nice. Worked out in the yard all day. Not all day, but a good part of it. That was nice. I don't get to do that very often. But my sobriety date is February 20th of 2000. I have a sponsor, and I have the honor and privilege of sponsoring guys. My home group is the Common Solution Group in Richmond, Virginia. We meet Tuesday and Thursday at noon at Bon Air Baptist Church. So if you're in town, please come and see us. On Tuesday, we have a topic meeting out of the big book, and we have a beginner's meeting that separates off from the main group. And that's been a really neat thing. We started it, I don't know, 6-9 months ago, something like that. It's 25 or 30 people in this noon beginner's meeting almost every Tuesday. It's just been awesome. And then on Thursday, we read something out of the 12 and 12, one of the steps or a tradition if it's the last Thursday, and discuss that. So I love my home group. Love the people in it. You know, I'm really grateful for that. And Gary was asking that you be courteous to the speaker while they're speaking, so I guess that means you won't throw hard objects, right? I was a little nervous. I'm a lot more calm now, so knowing that won't happen, hopefully. I'm supposed to tell you what I used to be like when I was drinking and what happened and what I'm like now that I'm sober and what AA has done for me in my life. I'm going to do it from the reverse real quick, and I'll get back to it. But what AA has done for me in my life has given me a peace through any storm that comes to my way that is indescribable. I've gotten through the worst things in my life in sobriety, and I did it with a peace that I didn't know was possible, with a knowing deep down that it was going to be okay regardless of what happened. That I was going to be okay. And I did that because my sponsor said, you need to pick it up with the guys you're working with in the steps. You need to keep your commitments. You need to make yourself available to the newcomer. And our book says that when all else fails, work with another alcoholic will save the day, and it's always been the direction when the worst things happen. And it works. You know? But I can't give away something I don't have, so I didn't have any of that before I got to AA. Believe me, I wasn't about giving anything away. I was about getting. All I could get of everything, you know, of everything. There was never enough of anything. I was born and raised in Richmond. My mom and dad split up when I was about 2 years old. And my earliest recollection of my dad was him picking me up on the weekends. He was at UVA on the GI Bill, and he'd take me up there and be big parties, and he bought me a little dog to play with, and, you know, it was a lot of commotion and excitement, and as a little kid, I thought that was pretty neat. My mother and I lived in this big old house with my great aunt and uncle, and we had an apartment upstairs, and I remember as a kid, though, and I never knew anything about my uncle getting drunk, but I do remember that my mother and my great aunt and my grandmother would come over, and they would be searching the house trying to find where he'd hid his liquor, you know, because he wasn't supposed to be drinking. And that's the earliest thing I really remember about alcohol. My dad's an alcoholic, and I say that because he does. I swore I'd never be like him. When I was about 6, we got a letter. And it said, my dad wrote this letter, said he was getting remarried, and he and his new wife were going to Europe for a couple of years, and they'd see us when they got back, and that's kind of what happened. And he came back and, you know, started the weekend thing again. And when I was about 10 years old, he and a buddy were making homemade eggnog, appropriate time of year, right? It was close to Christmas, and they made this homemade eggnog, and we had this bridge in Richmond called the Boulevard Bridge, and it's a real narrow bridge. It's a, back then they had a guy that, you know, came out and got your money, and it's not very wide. It's a 2-lane bridge. And he was so drunk I had to sit in his lap and steer the car across the bridge, and I'd never steered a car anywhere before. I was scared to death, and I swore then that, you know, I'd never do that to my kids. I'd never be like him. You know, sometimes I'd sit and wait 3 and 4 hours on the front porch for him to show up. And he'd show up smashed. And we'd take off and, you know, be driving 4 hours out to his mom's or something. A lot of stuff like that went on. My mother didn't drink. I asked her one time, why not? Because we'd go to these functions for her work, and everybody else would be going up to the bar and getting a drink, and she'd be getting a soda. And she said, well, I tried it one time, and it made me deathly ill. You know, and you know, I was deathly ill, and I just can't do that. So I didn't think a whole lot about it. It didn't have that effect on me. You know, I asked my stepdad why he didn't drink. These are questions I was asking as a teenager. And he said, well, you know, every time I drank, I got in trouble. I wrecked the car. I got locked up. You know, something bad always happened when I drank. And he stopped drinking at like 23 years old. You know, and the only thing he did was at Christmas time, he'd have a glass of eggnog. Homemade eggnog, and I became the supplier of the homemade eggnog after a while. But you know, the first Christmas or two that they were together, he had this homemade eggnog in the refrigerator. My mom didn't know it was spiked, and she did have a couple of sips out of it, and she was deathly ill all Christmas Eve and all Christmas Day. You know, there was it was not a good time around the house. But that is exactly what happened to her. You know, and she didn't drink. Good for her. I had the exact opposite experience with alcohol. The first time I drank, I was about 12 years old, and a couple of buddies of mine and I went to the shopping center within walking distance of our house, and we watched this lady come out of the liquor store with her brown bag, put it in her car, drive across the parking lot to another store, and it was summertime. She left her windows down. You know, it's not a smart thing to do. So we grabbed the bag, hit the woods, and that night we camped out in my backyard, and three of us drank a fifth of bourbon of some sort. I don't know what type it was. We mixed it with some stuff. We drank it out of the bottle. That night I did stuff I wouldn't normally do. You know, it freed me up to not worry about consequences, just to not care about anything other than having a good time. And alcohol did that for me for a lot of years. You know, I didn't start drinking every day. There wasn't alcohol in my house. You know, when we could get it, we drank. I had this old-timey barber that we used to go to, and we'd help him pick berries, and he made homemade wine, and he made corn mash. And when I was about 15, we were going to go to this party that a friend of mine from school was having. He had an older brother, and his family let us drink there. So I got a half a gallon of this wine from the guy, and it had a reputation. Everybody wanted some of it. So I gave part of it for a pint of rum. I gave part of it for a six-pack. I still had half of it left, and I drank all of that stuff. Plus, we had a trash can with grain and juices. And I heard people had a really good time. You know, I came to in the shower at about 3 o'clock in the morning. My friend's mother was trying to get me out of there to send me on my way. I don't remember a thing about it. And that's kind of the way it went. I had episodes like that, and I really didn't get consequences. My first wife's father was head of detectives for Chesterfield County, which is where we live, so that kept me out of a lot of scrapes. Just, you know, back then, honestly, you could get stopped, or I got stopped numerous times, even with the beer sitting between my legs. And the policeman said, boy, we don't do that around here. Get rid of it and let you go. You know, early on, people told me that, you know, you need to keep a bottle under your seat. And if you get stopped, just jump out and start chugging it. You know, you might get charged with drinking in public, but they're not going to get you for drunk driving. So, you know, that's kind of the way it went. I didn't realize it until after, really, truly, after getting in AA and working the steps with a sponsor, but my life was unmanageable from early on. I played basketball. My first wife was the homecoming queen and, you know, Miss State Fair and all this sort of stuff, and we were going to live happily ever after. And she was a wonderful, wonderful girl. She's a wonderful lady today. But my actions totally destroyed that. Because when I drank, I wasn't a very good husband. You know? We got married, I was 19, just turned 19, and she was 2 days out of high school. And all my buddies were going out drinking, I'd go out with them. You know, they were all single, and I was acting like I was. And later when I went to college, I worked for a while and had an opportunity to play basketball. So after we got married, I drank beer and smoked pot every single night. And I saw that when they brought this guy in straight out of college that I had to train and he was making 50% more than me, I thought, well, maybe there is something to this college thing. So I called the schools and so they said, come on out. I stopped drinking. I stopped smoking. I worked out every day, and 6 months later, I was in school. And it really wasn't the one I'd planned to go to. I was at University of Richmond working out with a friend that was on the football team, and the coach walked through and said, what are you doing? And 2 days later, I started school there. And I didn't have anything to drink or smoke for about a year and a half. The night I quit the team, I stopped at 7-Eleven. And from that point on until February 20th of 2000, I never went more than a day without a drink. I had jobs after I got out of school that I went to work for the phone company. And my first boss taught me about the birdbath martini, and it was like this. We were at Washington, had some legislators at lunch, and we started drinking then at lunch, and we went and saw some other people, took some other people out after work, and we closed the bars down at night. And I had jobs like that for 20 years. Most of that time, after the first 2 years, I had a bar in my office that the company paid for. And we had parties there, and, you know, it was every shrimp fest, beef festival, chicken fest, you name it, around the state, we went to it. And we'd have boxes of liquor, and we'd set up tables and just have a big time, you know. And there were a lot of things that we went to, too, that went to a lot of legislative receptions, a lot. And at those, I'd have to control my drinking. Because I had to remember what somebody said, and they had to understand what I was saying, you know. And there, we'd do that, and there was always a group of us that after that was over, we'd go out and drink somewhere like we wanted to, you know. Drank exactly like we wanted to. We didn't have to try to control it. I wasn't enjoying it when I was controlling it, even back then. So this just, you know, this kind of continued. I came home from work one day, and that first wife was, had cleaned out the apartment, bank account, all that kind of stuff. And she'd had enough, and I don't blame her. We tried to date for a little bit, and I was impatient with that. So, I blew any chance of that getting back together. So then I just was a single guy. Actually, the night I got impatient with it, I went back to the apartment, and there was a keg party there. Pool party, keg party. And I was off to the races. You know, I had really cut down during that time we were trying to get back, because I saw that correlation between me drinking and not being a good husband. You know, and I was able to cut down then. After that, from that keg party on, I was wide open. I was wide open until the end. I had a blind date that lasted 3 days. That was wife number two. And we had, and she's really a sweet girl, but we had a 12-year party. And so I was going through a divorce, and my wife now was going through a divorce. We were coming up on 19 years in January. But we were drinking buddies. A group of us used to go to a pub, sometimes at lunch, a lot of times after work, sometimes at lunch and stay till after work. And we got together. It's a match made in heaven. So my first exposure to anything dealing with any sort of detox or a program of recovery or anything. It's when I came home from work one day, and I'd been out drinking with customers, and she was supposed to be at home, and the kids were supposed to be there, and the car was in the garage, and nobody was there. I couldn't figure out what was going on. And she called my mother, and my mother took her to detox. And she needed it. She needed it. I knew she had a problem. But so I went to that. Then it was a longer program. It wasn't just a detox. They had a like a 2-week type deal, and I went to the family thing and went to hear an AA speaker meeting a couple times that they had there. And but my question to her was, you know, is it going to bother you if I drink when you come home? And she said no, and I said, great, we're going to be just fine. And by this time, most of my drinking career, except for early teens, I drank whatever it was on the rocks, you know. And I didn't realize until later that I really drank it that way because I really liked the bite because I knew what was coming right after it. But, it's going to be okay. I'm going to make it through the night. But, so she came home. I was drinking vodka then on the rocks out of stadium cups. And I've been doing that for a while. And I'd always told myself I could quit whenever I wanted to. But that kind of looked like this. On numerous occasions, I knew I was drinking too much. And I'd say, I gotta cut down. You know, I'm going to take a break for a couple of weeks. And then I can drink again like I want to. Well, 5 o'clock would come, and if I hadn't had a drink during the day, 5 o'clock was the magic hour, and I'd be okay. I didn't have to have one. But by 7 o'clock, I'm thinking, you know, I didn't have a problem at 5 o'clock. I don't have to have a drink now, but I'd like to have one, and I'm going to have one. And I'd be drinking at 7. So instead of 2 weeks, it was 2 hours. I could hold off. Because my mind is telling me, I don't have a problem. Because I didn't have to have one at 5. And I did that a bunch of times. You know? So she comes home, and it goes okay for a little while. And I'd left the phone company by then, started my own little business, and the rates dropped like a rock instead of the business. And so that was falling apart. That ex-wife and I had a son. She and I had probably the worst relationship any two people could have. I was drinking for oblivion every night. I couldn't not do that. And I'd come home and, you know, finally she said, I don't want you, this stuff's too tempting in the house. I don't want it in the house. So I hid it in the garage. I had this old metal trash can that I used to put fireplace ashes in, and I'd stick it down in there. And, hit it in a golf bag in my trunk, and I hit it above the utility room cabinets. I made sure I had it. And finally she said, I don't want you drinking here, you know. And I try to come home and not have a drink. And my whole world was falling apart. Our marriage was falling apart. Everything in my life was falling apart. And then meanwhile, we'd gone to this recovery worship service. She asked me to go with her. We got this little flyer in the mailbox, and it was a block away from the house. So we went there, and you know, I'd seen her changing, and I saw the people she was hanging around with changing, and I thought there must be something to the sharing stuff. So they had this men's group, this men in recovery group that met on Wednesday nights, and I started going to that. And I'd go in there and I'd talk about my anger and my resentments and her, and they just tell me to keep coming back. Everybody in there was in AA but me. And they just told me to keep coming back. And I went there for a year. And during that time is when all of this happened with me trying to stop. You know, I'd not drink and go to that meeting, and I'd come home and drink stadium cups of ice. You know? And finally she said, I don't want you drinking here. And I said, okay, I'll try not to do that. And I'd come home, and I'd sit over by her fireplace, and she'd describe it like this black cloud swirling over my head. And she'd look at me and say, you're so restless, irritable, and discontent, just have one drink. So I'd go down to the garage, and I'd fill up the stadium cup, and that's my one drink. Hey, she was in AA, and I had her convinced it was one drink. and I'd come up, and I'd take a few big gulps, right? And I'd get that, oh, it's going to be okay, I'm going to make it. And she'd describe it like flicking one of those light switches over there. But suddenly, I was a different person. You know, I was tolerable to be around, sometimes even funny. Before that, I was miserable to be around. I didn't look at it in those terms. I just knew that I was going to make it through the rest of the night. And she'd go to put her son down, and I'd sneak back down and fill it up again. You know, and she'd do something else. And I mean, I was drinking at least a liter a night for the last several years of my drinking. And I couldn't not do that. You know, I couldn't not have that drink. And once I started, I couldn't stop at the stadium cup. You know, I couldn't. I was drinking for oblivion, and I couldn't not do that. And everything was falling apart. I couldn't comply with her request. And I woke up one morning, and I don't know what happened, other than it was another night of me trying not to drink and drinking for oblivion. And I just had this overwhelming feeling that I couldn't go on another day in my life like it was. I didn't want to die. I wanted to live. I wanted to live. But I didn't know what to do. And I called this guy from that group. And he said, you know, let's meet. We met, asked me what was going on. I told him about all my woes. And he asked me about my drinking. I said, I have one, sometimes two, maybe three. And I didn't tell him they were stadium cups. And so here I've asked this guy for help, and I'm lying to him already. And he looked at me and said, well, you know, I don't know if you've got a problem with alcohol or not. But for me to try to work with you, you got to make a commitment to stop drinking for 3 weeks. And you have to go to at least 3 AA meetings a week, and you'll find out for yourself whether you got a problem. And I made that commitment to him. Because I needed help. I needed help. I wanted help. I just thought I could find help that I didn't have to stop drinking. You know, so I went a little less than 2 days. I was coming out of my skin. I knew, I was going to take a drink that night somehow, some way, if I didn't do something. And there was a meeting book, Aware and Win, sitting over on our kitchen counter. And I just went over there, opened up the book, found the soonest meeting, the closest to our house as I could, and went. Nobody, I didn't know anything about it. I'd been to some AA speaker meetings before, but I'd always been drunk. I don't remember it, but the first year I got sober, I went to this little spiritual retreat, and I went to sit down by this lady named Sammy, who I appreciate a lot. She said, I was wondering how long it's going to take you to get here. I said, what do you mean? She said, I remember you coming into Repos drinking out of that stadium cup of vodka. That's the clubhouse in town that apparently I was taking my vodka in to have a drink and listen to a speaker. I don't know. I don't remember. But anyway, I went to this meeting not drinking and wanting help. And they asked if it was anybody's first meeting, and I said it was mine. This is the first one I'd been to for me. It's the first one I'd been to not drinking. And they had a speaker that spoke for about 20 minutes, and the speaker selects a topic. Well, surprise, surprise, he picked the first step. And, you know, powerless over alcohol, my life is unmanageable. I knew my life was unmanageable. What any question in my mind, you know? I couldn't manage my drinking. I couldn't manage anything. I used to pride myself on my ability to make decisions, to get things done, and nothing was working in my life. Nothing. You know, so the powerless over alcohol thing I didn't quite get yet. You know, I just didn't quite, it was just, how could I be powerless over that? So anyway, they split in these groups, and I sit around this table of men that started sharing their experience. And I listened to something that everyone said. They talked about, you know, once they started drinking, they didn't know what was going to happen or when they were going to stop. I knew what was going to happen. I was drinking for oblivion. I knew what was going to happen. But I could not do that. You know? They talked about this obsession that, you know, will take me back to a drink. And they pointed out in the big book where it says that if you don't have a problem with alcohol, you should be able to leave it alone for a year without much difficulty. I couldn't imagine a year. I mean, I'd gone 2 days. I was going nuts. Couldn't imagine that. You know, and they talked about how they felt and some of the things that they did. And I related to something that every single man at that table shared. And finally, this old guy looked at me and said, "Well, Bob, what about you?" And it was the first time I had, I guess, a moment of clarity, whatever you want to call it. It was the first time I was able to be honest with myself, you know, and say that, yes, this is me. You know, they asked me what happened when I tried to go out to the bar and have a couple of drinks. I never got home when I was supposed to. I usually closed the place down. It always happened. You know, and I thought it was because I wanted to. And if I wanted to, so why do I always have these guilt feelings and about being late? You know, I really wanted to keep my commitments, and I couldn't do that once I started drinking. So that night, I was able to say, yes, this is me. You know, and it was a relief. You know, it was almost that same big, it's going to be okay. Like I used to get from taking a few big gulps of vodka, because I knew that there was a solution here. And I haven't had a drink since that night. But I went to that meeting knowing I was going to drink if I didn't do something. You know, and I told them about that too, and they said, "Well, you just need to pray and ask God to keep you sober the rest of the night." So I get outside, and this old guy that, I say he's old guy, he had white hair, I don't know. I get outside and he goes, "You know, you really need to get somebody to help you with this." And I said, "Well, I've already asked somebody for help." He said, "Yeah, who's that?" And I told him. He started laughing. I didn't like that at all. I said, "What's so funny?" He said, "Well, I sponsor him." I had no idea. I didn't know who this guy was. You know, it's kind of a first God moment. Some people might want to call it coincidence. I've had too many God moments to know it wasn't. In AA. You know, here the guy that I'd asked for help, the guy that's helping him, helped me to see the truth about me. Nobody knew I was going there. Nobody knew who I was there. You know. So I go out to the car and I just say, "God, I don't want to do this anymore. Just please help me stay sober tonight." And almost as soon as I finish, this guy's knocking on the window and said, "We're going to eat and you're going with us." They didn't ask, they told me. And probably one of the most spiritual things I've ever said was, "Okay." You know, just listening to somebody else. And I went to this little dive with about 20 people, some of the craziest people I've ever been with in my life. And they were telling all these stories. They were talking about their drinking. They were talking about some of the stuff that they did. And I laughed that night until tears were rolling down my face. And I hadn't laughed like that for a long, long time. You know? And I didn't realize it until later, but I never thought about drinking again that night. You know? And I called the guy the next morning that had asked for help and said, "Hey, I'm an alcoholic." He said, "That's great." I said, "What's so great about that?" He said, "Same thing. We've got a solution." And we got together that day. And he started reading the big book to me. He'd read a couple of paragraphs and share his experience. And then he asked me how I related to that. And we did that all throughout the book. Some of you guys might know Val from Richmond. She used to come to my office and bring the big book in and set it over on the conference table and go, "You get out here. I'm going to sit down. I want to make sure you got this first step right." I love her to death, but she did that, and she was really helpful to my sobriety. But that's the type of people I was hanging around that were serious about recovery. You know? They were really serious about recovery. And, you know, my sponsor always says at page 30, a relapse is a page 30 problem. I had to fully concede to our innermost self that we're real alcoholics. This is the first step in recovery. And I had a lot of people helping me to find that, you know, helping me to see the truth about me. And I'm very grateful for that. sponsor had asked me about my beliefs when we got to step two, and I told him, and his question was, how's that working for you? Yeah, wasn't working. You know, might have had some ideas and feelings and that sort of stuff, but it wasn't working for me. You know, so he told me to set aside everything I thought I knew and work these steps and have a new experience. He told me my job was to seek God. That was my job. You know, and he told me to start praying every morning. He told me to pray throughout the day. He told me to call him. He gave me some little exercises to do. One was that I had to do something nice for someone every day for 30 days. And they couldn't know that I'd done it. And I had to call and tell him that I'd done my task, but I couldn't tell him what I'd done or who I'd done it for. And that didn't make sense. You know, I like to talk about doing something good. And what that taught me, though, was when I don't talk about doing something good, it keeps me filled up. And when I talk about it, that goes away. You know, that's what anonymity is about. You know? We do things and we don't have to go around bragging or talking about it. And it keeps you filled up. It's part of the juice, you know, that we need around. And when we got to the third step, I was willing to go through the rest of the steps. You know, I was willing to turn my life over to God as I understood him then that day, knowing that that was going to change. Because my sponsor told me it would. You know, he said, by working these steps, your relationship with God will change. So are you willing to do it right now as you understand God, whatever that is? Yeah, I was. You know, we said the third step prayer, and he tricked me. He had me write this list of people that I was resentful at. Right then and there. You know, and I did, and he said, well, you know, we got some more things to do with this, but first of all, these people are occupying space in your head. And they're probably not even thinking about you. You know, they're eating your lunch. So, do you want to get free of that or not? I said, yeah, I do. He said, well, you need to make a decision to forgive each and every one of those people for whatever they've done. And it starts with a decision. Your feelings aren't going to change right away. But it starts with a decision. You got to start somewhere. And so I did. I made that decision. We said a little prayer and, you know, told God I forgave these people for whatever it was I thought that they'd done. And it was only what I thought they'd done. But that freed me up to go on with the fourth step, really, you know, because I wasn't holding stuff against them anymore. But I already had it written down, had their name, knew what they'd done. So then it made it easier for me to look at where I was out of blame, you know. And dragged my feet a little bit on the fourth step because I didn't really drag my feet. He had to go out of town, and then I had to go out of town two times, and we were getting ready to. I hadn't quite finished it, but we were going to do the fifth step. I was going to be finished by the time we did it. And finally I said, I really felt like I was moving backwards. You know, I had been going forward. I was very, very busy in AA. And I felt like suddenly I was moving backwards. You know, and I called him and said, we need to set a time that we can both keep. I got to do this fifth step. And we did. It was that coming weekend, I think it was, at his house. His family was going to be out of town. And rode out to his house. He lived out in Powhatan. And I get out there, and I really thought I'd finished it. And on the way, I thought I had too much time to drive, I guess. I started thinking of other things I needed to put on there. And I got out my car, and I'm, you know, writing on the hood and on the paper and take it in. But by this time, I knew he and I were so much alike, I wasn't afraid to share anything with this guy. You know, we were just alike. And I shared everything that was on there. He pointed out some patterns that I had not seen. You know, he was able to see things in that I couldn't see. What drove me to do some things. You know, some of my thinking, some of my feelings, acting on my feelings. Feelings aren't fact. You know, they're just feelings. So that was really, really helpful. And we finished that, and he said, you know, Bob, do you want to be this guy anymore? And I didn't. And he said, you don't ever have to be this guy anymore. And you don't have to drink again either. And he sent me to his sunroom to pray for an hour. Didn't send me home. Sent me to his sunroom with my book and said, I want you to pray and ask God if you've left out anything else that needs to be shared. And are all the steps up to this point? Are they thorough? And are you willing to have God remove all this gunk that we just talked about? And I came back out, I was willing. And right then and there, we did the seven-step prayer. Yeah. And I felt different. I truly felt different when I did that. And before I left, he gave me the instructions for the 8-step. You know, and he helped me pick off things on my inventory that needed to go on there and told me to finish it up. You know, kind of go by what he had told me. And so I finished it up. I had to write it out. He wanted me to write it out. Write out, you know, I did this, this, and this. I was selfish, dishonest, inconsiderate, fearful, whatever it was. I was wrong. You know, and then I was supposed to say, is there anything else I've done to harm you? And just pause and listen. And then ask at the end, what can I do to make these things right? So I had to write all that out for each person. And I was told that I could take that in there with me and read it if I needed to. Because he didn't want me to be straying from what I was supposed to say. You know, I don't need to get into a whole bunch of other stuff. I need to keep it short, sweet, and simple. And he met my wrong. So, I got things that I thought, people that I thought I needed to make amends to in the 8th step. He said no. A lot of them were females that I thought I needed to go make amends to. And he said no for most of those. Some he said yes. You know, so some of the people that I had on the inventory, I didn't think I owed amends. He said I did, and I just followed his lead. You know, I've never been steered wrong ever by a sponsor. I've had 3 sponsors in my sobriety, and I've never been steered wrong, not even remotely. So, anyway, got to that 9th step, and you know, I told you I'd never be like my dad. We went for periods of time, sometimes going a year plus without even speaking or seeing each other. And I went out to make amends to him and sort of tell him what was going on in my life before we had a formal amends thing going on, and found out he'd gotten sober in AA. Had no idea, you know. And really what I'd done to him was cut him out of his son's life, his only son's life, and his grandchildren's lives. Because my kids were his only grandchildren at the time. He has others now. But what he wanted me to do was to include him. And we've made an effort to do that, and still do. And he's a dad that I never dreamed he could be. You know, he's a grandfather I never imagined. I've gotten to be there for him. And you know, my ex-wife, that we've probably had the worst relationship of any 2 human beings, when I told her what I'd done wrong and asked, you know, is there anything else I've done to harm you? I listened to her 45 minutes. But I only thought I knew how I'd harmed her. It was from my perspective. I got to hear from her perspective, you know. And what it really did was help me to be ever more mindful and willing to do what she asked me to do to make it right, because it wasn't anything I couldn't do. You know, she's a good mother, and I need to give her credit for that. It's all about our son. We are friends now. It's an amazing thing, and it's all from AA. You know, I try to make amends when I've done something quickly, and I practice that early on. My first sponsor said, you got plenty of stuff for the 4-step. I don't want you adding more to it. If you know you've done something wrong, admit it right then. And the first time I tried that was with my wife. You know, I don't know what it was about. I do know that I reacted in a loud and harsh tone. And I realized it a couple minutes later, and I went to her and said, hey, I shouldn't have spoken to you that way. You know, what can I do to make it right? And she just asked that I not be that way. You know, try not to do that again. And I said I would. You know, what happened, though, when something like that happened in the past, we would be going in separate directions for a day or two, a cold shoulder. And in a few minutes, instead of that, we were on the same path. It showed me how this stuff works. You know, it's so simple and it works. Well, the 11th step, he had me reading page 86 and 87 early on, long before I got to it. You know, asking God for direction for the day. Pausing when agitated. That was a biggie. And, you know, I still try to start my day out with that still. I don't always read it, but I do it. And the guys that I sponsor, a lot of times I've had them call in their morning, it's going crazy, and they, you know, nothing's going right, and I'll ask them, have they done that? No. Well, why don't you stop now and do it? You know, because we can restart our day anytime, or we can continue on in the madness. It's up to us. We've got a tool we can use. The 12th step, I've had an opportunity to see people's lives change right before my eyes. To see that dark stare go to a light twinkle in their eyes. It's an amazing experience. It's something I hope nobody misses, you know. There's a lot of people that need the help, and there's nothing like seeing that. And I mentioned earlier that, you know, my sponsors have always said, Bob and all else fails, work another alcoholic will save the day. And that has taken me through, as I said, the worst thing. I had cancer 7.5 years ago. They gave me a 50-50 shot of living. Told me I was going to have to do chemo and radiation, all sorts of dire things. And that was the answer. Yeah, I met with my sponsor. Well, first of all, speaking of Dillon, the night I got the news, and I did it anyway. The guys went with me. And I had a peace during that time. The next night I was speaking to jaywalkers. And I did it anyway. And I had a peace during that time. I was doing a fist step with somebody that week. I did it anyway. And I had a peace during that time. You know, and these things helped me to wanting to be of service to my family, to the guys I sponsor, got me out of me. And I'm convinced that and prayers from a whole lot of people got me through that. You know, I had to go in for an operation the next week. And they said it had spread. They didn't know how far. And there was this guy from my home group that was like 22 years sober. And he'd had lung cancer. He was being treated in the same hospital with chemo and radiation. And he had his last treatment there. And they said, you've got 3 to 6 months to live. He left that treatment. I was in the same hospital, and he came to my room and said, Bob, I've been where you got to go. We're going to walk through this together. I want you to call me every day. My phone's open to you 24/7. Call me. We're going to do this together. So the next day, my doctor comes in, and he goes, shaking his head. My mom was there, my wife was there, and he goes, I can't explain it. We can't find a trace of cancer anywhere. You know, and he said, I can't explain it, but we can't. And he left. So I called my sponsor at the time, and I said, how do I tell this guy my good news? He's been given the death sentence. What do I do? How can I tell him? He said, Bob, what do you usually do? I said, what do you mean? He said, what do you usually share? I said, what's been shared with me? He goes, yeah. I've been having trouble praying for my own healing. And he had told me, he said, Bob, don't you have a wife and sons that depend on you? Don't you help a lot of guys? And they kind of depend on you too, don't they? Pray for your own healing. Others will be helped. And when I shared my news with him, I shared the problem that I'd had, and he was having the same problem. And I got to share with him what had been shared with me. And he lived for like 2.5 years. And pretty good. I mean, I got to see him all the time. When we went to the hospital, I got to take him his 7-Eleven coffee because that was his favorite of anything. You know, he's an awesome, awesome guy. But all of those things came about because of Alcoholics Anonymous. It's something you just don't want to miss. Get it all. Don't just do part of it. Get it all. I try to stay in the middle of the circle and triangle. I've always had a home group. I've always had some sort of service position. Because it's needed. I mean, you know, it takes a lot to put things on to do this meeting. You know, there's a lot of jobs to be done. And just jump in, volunteer, hang on, have the ride of your life. Thanks.